This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
The fact that government actions are putting some people out of business is not new. And that fact actually is the tragic part. It's not new. Last month in Calgary, 8,000 business owners facing double-digit tax increases finally got together, had enough, and demanded the city rein in spending. Well, that hasn't happened yet in Vancouver. But come on, with so many businesses being pushed to the brink, I think that may change. And a hint to business owners, if you're listening, unless that does, unless you take aggressive action, government is not going to stop till it puts you out of business. Remember what happened with Dulux Paints on Broadway in Vancouver? Been in the same location for 50 years, but finally, government taxes pushed them out. Their property taxes last year, I think, were $22,000. This year, up another $16,000, bringing the total property tax bill to an astounding $225,000. They cried no mas and closed the store. As Global News reported this week, the Manifesto Hair Salon, which was struggling till Sally Trainer took it over in 2010 in Vancouver, turned the business around, only to find the government still wants more and more. Her property taxes on her little 750-square-foot business store are now $800 a month, double since she took over. Instead of celebrating her success and keeping the doors open, government is forcing her to take action, downsize, and, God forbid, go like Dulux Paint and be forced out of business. What's the anti-business crowd, along with our self-described progressions, what they don't get is that they refuse to see that businesses are facing a myriad of tax increases. Come on, any business got to pay higher Canada Pension Plan premiums now, every year for the next 4 years. BC, they now pay a carbon tax, but here's the thing, it's no longer revenue neutral. They're actually the biggest disadvantage in the country on that score. Of course, Alberta, I know, has canceled their carbon tax, but if the feds come in and reinstate another one, and I know there'll be court cases, then BC would be at the biggest disadvantage. It's just a bigger disadvantage right now compared to Alberta. It doesn't even pay. I mean, the list just goes on. In BC, you can also add on a new health tax that the employers have to pay for every employee. And at the same time, they're mandatory insurance rates. Remember, there's no real insurance competition in British Columbia. Their insurance rates for vehicles are up over 3 times the rate of inflation. So here's really the question. Should the government really be in the business of putting people out of business? Because that's what they're good at. The biggest obstacle in the way of business surviving and thriving is now government. Just like they're the biggest obstacle to affordable housing when they add on hundreds of thousands of dollars to the cost of a new house or condo and various fees or the cost of zoning regulations, delays, that cost more, and taxes, of course. Quick example, though. Recent study by the Canadian Federation of Independent Business estimates that the combined regulatory burden of three levels of government cost businesses $36 billion in 2017. And of course, that hits small business the hardest because they don't have a staff standing there ready to go. At times, they don't have the expertise to handle the regulatory paper load. I mean, it takes hundreds of hours to simply comply with government rules and regulations. So again, back to the question, should government be in the business of putting people out of business? Because it is happening all the time. Just wondering, does it actually bother you? Because if it does, you're in the minority. And it certainly doesn't bother the majority of politicians. I find it outrageous. We're talking about people's livelihood, their family's well-being, and again, it doesn't bother them a bit. It's tough enough to make a go in this kind of competitive environment. You sure as heck don't need the big foot of government on your throat working against you. Sometimes I think the government's motivated by anti-capitalist, anti-business ideology, and we got plenty of those people fed by a teachers' union, arts faculties at universities, and many in the media that are predominantly anti-business. Other times I think it's just cluelessness. I mean, look at the federal Liberal small business tax proposals introduced in the summer of 2017. There was absolutely no sign that the government even had an inkling as to how difficult it is, how much work is involved or the risk entailed to make a business succeed. I'll guarantee you there are very few in government, especially in the self-described progressive left, who even consider the impact on business of new taxes and regulations. Gosh, remember in BC, finance minister stood up and said, no, they didn't take into account, they did no modeling on the impact of the NDP's new speculation tax on real estate, the new school tax, the increase in the property purchase tax, increase in the foreign buyers tax in conjunction in an environment with a new stress test and rising interest rates. Nope, didn't do any modeling about what impact that might have on people and their jobs. Wow. That's just how far down business is in the agenda. I mean, anyone want to bet that before introducing any new tax, that the party in power sits down and says, let's also figure out what's happening at the other two levels of government? Because that's the story. It's the old, there's only one taxpayer, but there's three levels of government working hard to add to the burden. But it's not just government, by the way, who couldn't care less about small business. I suspect they're just reflecting the attitude of the majority of Canadians. I mean, I'll give you an example. Do you think the pipeline opponents spend a moment thinking about the impact on small businesses and their employees if the pipeline's canceled? Well, of course not. Government tax and regulatory policy is putting people out of business, increasing unemployment, devastating families. In short, the anti-business crowd that's so prominent in public sector unions, to public education, to state broadcaster, has now grown to include workers. And it wasn't just, hey, we're against business, we're now against workers. Which I guess is why so few people blink when a government forces someone out of business. Michael Levy joins me on the line right now. Mike, I wanted to talk about, this massive change that we continue to see in the environment, this about-face when it comes to interest rates, and I want to ask you about the impact on currencies on that. So, you know, all of a sudden we're back into a negative yield situation with about $12.5, $13 trillion worth of bonds. You got most countries talking about lowering rates, the U.S. being the one we're watching most closely. But Canada, not so much on the same page, at least it sounds like it's not.
Well, they're not, Mike, and we're not. And we could see this coming with the employment news particularly being the headline item the last several months, where Canadian employment job rates continue to surprise and impress. And even during last month, when they looked at the May numbers in the United States, and their numbers surprisingly fell off, Canada was surprisingly strong. We also have our GDP here in Canada higher than what the Bank of Canada was projecting, and also higher than what the private industry economists were projecting. So now what you've got is the U.S. talking of lowering rates, and it's almost a slam dunk for a quarter of 1% lowering at the end of July. Some were talking 0.5%, but their most current job numbers surprised to the upside. I mean, you're talking 224,000 jobs they added. So they may not cut as fast or as much as what the investment public thought, but it's going to be faster than Canada because of what's going on here. Canada is stand pat while the U.S. lowers rates. Well, all that does is drive, and you were talking about currencies, money out of those countries where rates are going down, some to minus rates like in Europe, and it's going to drive it into Canada. And when they come into Canada for our treasury bills, our bonds, or whatever they want to invest in, they've got to buy the Canadian dollar. Hence, a Canadian dollar today at 76.5 cents, and a U.S. dollar that is starting to weaken somewhat, and Europe, which is really on the ropes again and is going to start lowering interest rates, and we've got some negative interest rates going on in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a competition for money. I mean, it's not hard to look good if you're giving 2% and Germany's giving minus something, you know. And that's what seems to be the phenomenon, is a ton of money coming out of Europe into the bond market, parking itself. The other thing, by the way, was so fascinating about that, I don't want to digress too much, Mike, but, you know, people are asking me, well, why would someone buy a negative yield bond? You know, a bond where you put up, $1 billion and you're guaranteed 5 years later to get a little less. Well, the reason is that, to me, reflects the lack of confidence in the banking system. They have more confidence in holding a government bond that money's going to still be there indeed in the end than they do with some of the banking problems there. And, you know, in the end, you know, North America is going to be the beneficiary as money comes in. But, you know, the link that you've made here that I want to make sure people understand is, hey, if our interest rates, relatively speaking, look better than the U.S., that'll attract some money here. And do you have any numbers that you think maybe the Canadian buck goes to?
Well, 2 points here, Mike. First of all, you've got a Canadian dollar that when you look at where it might be going, you've got Sebastian Lavoie of Laurentian Bank saying that we're going to 80 cents. Well, okay, mm-hmm. That's one economist, but well-respected, and it might not go to 80 cents, Mike, but that's the direction in which it's going, And talking of buying U.S. dollars, that puts a U.S. dollar at $1.25 Canadian. Well, heck, we were up at $1.37 Canadian just a couple of months ago. And you take at RBC, they're talking about a 78.15 cent U.S. dollar. Well, that's $1.28 to buy a U.S. dollar. And Mike, just back to the other point is people will go for negative interest rates. We talked about this, you and I, back in 2009, 2010. They want to guarantee that they're going to get their money back. So they are willing to take even a little less as the economy sour or turns south. They want a place where they can park their money, even if they have to take a little less to get it back.
And it's just, it's a great story in this. It just explains that what we're looking at is how money moves around. As you say, they're making choices. And then this underlying thing of confidence. And I think that's what's happening in Europe. They do not trust what's going on with Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank. You know, they're not going to merge now with BNP Paribas. You know, you've got Italian bank problems. You've got Spanish bank problems, all of this stuff. And I think some people are just saying, you know what, as you just described, I just want to make sure I get my money back. I got to park it. You can't put it under the mattress when it's this kind of size we're talking. So I'd rather park it at that point and, you know, have more faith in government than the banking system. But ergo, here comes money coming in. I think a lot of it's gone into the 10-year bond in the U.S. That's why the 10-year bond rate is down. You know, it's only, it's hit under 2%. Ours is under 1.5%. A lot of these gyrations about money moving back and forth and confidence driving it this way and that. And I think it's left a level of uncertainty because now we've got people going, hey, I still think the Canadian economy is going to be weak next year, so that'll keep our rates down. And other people saying, as you just did, Mike, you know, no, they're looking for a rally first. One thing I'm sure of, I think it's all going to come true. We just have to get the timing right.
Mike, absolutely correct. And I think going into next year, here's the bigger picture, and it is a simple bigger picture. If this is what happens, if this happens, then there's going to be a reaction. If this is what happens with a Canadian dollar goes to 78, 79, mm-hmm. 80, that number doesn't matter. The fact is, then the Bank of Canada will have to step in and lower rates simply to defend our economy and our exports, because at a 78 or 80 cent dollar, our exports start to price themselves out of the markets. So the next year and that next move from the Canadian dollar, if this all unfolds, is going to be to cut interest rates here in Canada in order to lower our rates so we are more competitive on the way we export.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time. I'll tell you right now, Mike, just quickly, if we see 80 cents in that dollar, I won't be able to get out of it fast enough. No, well, I get a chance to change my mind, but sitting here, I'll take that exchange rate and get more U.S. dollars. But in the meantime, we'll wait and see, Mike, and I'll talk to you next week.
Have a good weekend.
Time now for Instant Wisdom. Candace Owens is a nightmare for the progressive left in the U.S. She describes herself as a former liberal, former Democrat, who is now a conservative, but that's not the nightmare part. She's a young, articulate black woman who now attacks the failures of the victim culture, the state-dependent culture that's pushed by the Democratic Party. And there's no denying the failures of that approach and raising, and their failure to raise much of the black community out of poverty, especially when you look at the record on inner-city public schools. She's highly critical of the reverse racism of Black Lives Matter. She's a conundrum because she's pro-life and pro-LGBTQ. She has needed police protection from attacks from Antifa and has zero tolerance for the hate that's so evident. In this clip, she's testifying before Congress on the rise of white nationalism and hate, although as you hear, she turns the tables around pretty quickly and takes dead aim at big government and the Democratic Party, politics of fear. Here's the clip.
During my formative years, I had the privilege of growing up in my grandfather's home. It's going to shock the committee, but not once, not in a single breath of a conversation, did my grandfather tell me that I could not do something because of my skin color. Not once did my grandfather hold a gripe against the white man. I was simply never taught to view myself as a victim because of my heritage. I learned about faith in God, family, and hard work. Those were the only lessons of my childhood. There isn't a single adult today that in good conscience would make the argument that America is a more racist or a more white nationalist society than it was when my grandfather was growing up. And yet we're hearing these terms sent around today because what they want to say is that brown people need to be scared, which seems to be the narrative that we hear every 4 years right ahead of a presidential election. Here are some things we never hear. 75% of the black boys in California don't meet state reading standards. In inner cities like Baltimore, within five high schools and one middle school, not a single student was found to be proficient in math or reading in 2016. The single motherhood rate in the black community, which is at 23% in the 1960s when my grandfather was coming up, is at a staggering 74% today. I am guessing there will be no committee hearings about that. There are more black babies aborted than born alive in cities like New York, and you have Democrat Governor Andrew Cuomo lighting up buildings to celebrate late-term abortions. I could go on and on. My point is that white nationalism does not do any of those things that I just brought up. Democrat policies did. Let me be clear. The hearing today is not about white nationalism or hate crimes. It's about fear-mongering, power, and control.
There you go. You get a sample of that. Candace Owens taking government to task for their abysmal record. One of my big things is it's outrageous what they've done to inner city schools or the way they failed to rescue them and just no action being taken. Very pleased to welcome back to the show. I've got Eric Coffin on with me, HRA Advisors. Eric, first of all, appreciate you finding time in the weekend, and what a great time to be chatting with you when you look at what's happened in the world of gold.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again, Mike. And yes, the sentiment is a little more positive than it has been for quite a while, actually.
Just give us sort of the broad outline of what do you think's driving it? What's changed that's all of a sudden, because gold was bumping up against, we can pick a number, say that 1360, then it bounced way back down, back up several times, and then it broke through, which I think is significant. But what was behind that?
I mean, really, it's all about the U.S. Federal Reserve more than anything else. I mean, you've got geopolitical risk factors, which I never like to see as a gold driver, but you take what you can get. And the chief among those is a U.S.-China trade dispute. But really, it's all about the Fed right now. Early this year, the Federal Reserve, which had been sort of hawkish, really turned tail and turned quite dovish this year. I think they panicked a bit when the New York markets got hit so hard late last year. Of course, they're getting berated by Trump daily to cut interest rates. And if you believe the bond market, and the bond market has got a better track record than the equities market when it comes to this sort of stuff, they're pricing in three or four more rate cuts between now and, say, early 2020. If we see that level of rate cuts, that means we're basically going to be back into negative real interest rates, and that is the best environment for gold. That's when gold really performs, when the Fed's behind the curve, and it seems to intentionally be planning to go behind the curve. There's expectation there'll be a rate cut this meeting at the end of July. They were talking, a lot of people were thinking 50 basis points. I wasn't, but I think 25 basis points is fairly likely. They pretty much said they were going to do it at the last meeting. And there's expectation of a couple more cuts. And if that trend stays in place, then we're in an environment where we're likely to see, even though we've already seen a big move in gold prices in the last month, I think one of equal size over the next few months is pretty likely if the Fed sticks to this path.
Are you looking at... The question then becomes, is this the big one? I mean, gold's been in a bear market and languishing. Do you have signs that you think this is the beginning of the big sort of longer-term move? Because we've had false starts before.
It may be. I mean, admittedly, I tend to be more, I'm not a chart guy, a long-term chart guy, so I tend to be more tactical, I guess, about it. Mm-hmm. To me, this feels like I could see gold moving to 1,500-1,600 fairly easily with this backdrop. I do know that friends of mine who are sort of long-term technical analysts and who, I might add, were correctly bearish through most of the last few years, several of these guys are telling me that they think this is, in fact, quote-unquote, the big one, that this will be a multi-year rally that's going to take gold to new highs higher than it saw several years ago. So you're talking $2,000 plus. I prefer to just take it a day at a time, and rather than making big giant predictions. But yeah, it feels like we could have that, because I personally think there's fairly high odds of U.S. goes into at least a mild recession around the end of this year. And that will just reinforce that negative interest rate trend and reinforce the monetization and probably weaken the U.S. dollar if the U.S. growth rate moderates and sort of comes closer to the other currency blocks. All of those things just add to the monetary background in terms of driving gold higher.
Does that, you know, is it just simply a case of, well, I mean, not simply, everything's more complex, but one of the factors being, you know, if interest rates were at 12%, for example, well, it's just pretty tough to compete with that. You know, if you, you know, gold doesn't have a yield, that kind of thing. But now that they drop down and they go down further, you're not really paying a price for owning gold compared to, I mean, heck, if you're in Europe, you'd rather own gold probably than, you know, than a negative bond, as an example. So is
that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a huge stock of the world's government debt, you know, if you look at G7 issued debt by G7 countries, a huge percentage of that's already literally negative interest rates. I mean, I find this mind boggling personally, but you've got governments in Europe issuing and at the date of issuance, they're negative interest rate bonds.
Yeah.
And apparently they're having no trouble selling them, which I just find bizarre personally. But in that kind of environment, there, you know, the whole quote-unquote cost of owning gold thing goes out the window. And if you add falling rates to the point where the drops below inflation, you actually get negative real interest rates on top of the negative nominal rates. I mean, that's, you know, if you're a gold bug, I'm not really, but if you're a gold bug, that's about the best environment you could possibly hope for in terms of price increases.
Well, I do see, though, it is part of this bigger trend, as I say, where once you start losing confidence, and I think what we're seeing in Europe is that you're losing confidence in the banking system. And
yeah.
So you're just saying, hey, I'll accept almost the cost of government safekeeping my money. And that's the negative interest rate cost. And let's say, you know, so you're losing, you know, pick any number, $1,000 a year. You sort of go, well, I think that's the cost of making my money safe. And I think gold does participate from that point of view also, where it starts being once again seen as a store of wealth that and you all, I don't think it's a coincidence you've also seen it at a time when the cryptocurrencies were going up, all of it sort of giving the same message that we're not comfortable anymore with what we're seeing in the banking and in Europe in general, so some of the money just ends up there.
Yeah, I think gold, and I, you know, I'm not a big crypto fan, but you can make the same argument for crypto.
Yeah.
There are two asset classes where that asset isn't someone else's liability. And that's, you know, I think there is definitely a decrease in confidence. So many governments are running insane deficits. No one who can do math sees any way out. I don't see any way out. I don't know how they get out of this. So you've just seen this big fall in confidence. But the difference with gold is there is no, you know, it's not like a government bond where if you're buying a bond, you're implicitly saying, I trust that government not to screw up. I trust them to pay me back. If you're buying gold, you're saying, this isn't anybody else's liability. I don't have to depend on a third party not to screw up in order to get my money back out.
Eric, I just wanted to get to, okay, so we talk about the gold price itself, but get the lay of the land. What's happened? Has that been reflected in the gold prices of equities, for example, or seniors or not juniors, what have you?
It has been. I mean, it's, you know, the last couple of years are pretty ugly, as you know, Mike. But things have got a lot better in the last month, and specifically in the last month, pretty much from the 1st of June. Both the GDX and the GDXJ, and those are two gold indexes predominantly in the U.S., but they're senior indexes. I mean, even the junior GDX isn't really junior. They're all producers. But both of those indexes have moved up 25% in the last month. They had a dip yesterday on a quote-unquote strong employment report, but actually closed at the day highs. I was actually very impressed at how well they held up. Normally when the gold price moves, and this goes for any commodity really, any metal, when the metal price moves, money goes downhill, which basically means the price moves start with the large producers, then they work down to the medium ones, the small ones. We're only really seeing the leading edge of the buying when it comes to developers and explorers. Most of those really haven't moved up that much. But we will, if the gold price holds up and keeps moving higher, we will see that. It usually takes several weeks for it to really start to filter down to the juniors. I haven't seen a lot of, only really in the last 2 days have I started to see new financings, which is another, you know, sign that things are back to being healthy. And I think even the guys running these companies, I mean, everybody's been beaten down so many times that even the guys running juniors are just kind of waiting to make sure that it's not just another mirage. But I think even though this is a slow part of the year normally for financings, I think this summer is actually going to be pretty strong, and we'll start seeing a lot of money start to flow in. One guy I know who owns a fund over in Europe, a gold fund, he told me that last Thursday was the biggest one-day inflow he's ever had.
Wow.
But he said, he said the fund's been like nowhere for the last two or three years. So he said,
yeah,
I need a few days like this before I'm really getting anywhere. But he said that shows you the tide seems to have really turned.
When you're looking more at the junior side, obviously this is why I think your letter does so well for people, because you have to know the management track record, what's going on, how realistic is it, all of those kinds of things. So you must be busy.
Yep. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm revisiting a lot of things. I'm looking, for new stories. I always do, but I'm also, making sure I'm right up to date on what are all these guys doing. I just added a new company, and that's your comment about management is particularly prescient in that one, because that's one that's actually a late stage company that should be going into production within the next year. But in their case, it's all about execution. It's all about the management. That was really the reason why I picked it.
And when you go into those, what time frame does every story have a different time frame, or you just sort of say, as a rule of thumb, if you're going to buy a junior or a developing mine, you better be prepared to hold it for X. If you're buying a senior, X, that kind of stuff.
When you're buying the big companies, you're basically playing the commodity price, really. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them have better or worse growth rates, but really any of the really big companies, when you're buying them, you're playing the commodity cycle. You're playing the price moves, because they're just going to move with the prices. Ideally, I prefer to go sort of in this lower end down the food chain a bit. I like looking for explorers that can be explosive if they make a new discovery, or developers that are getting to the point where they're going to push up what's called the Lassonde curve. I mean, they're kind of in the dead spot there where it's kind of boring, but when the actual development starts, that's when they get re-rated.
And what about those companies that, there used to be so many big, there were medium-sized companies, but well-known names. And of course, when the prices dropped, it didn't go dormant, but, the prices come way down from their glory days. Do you look at those ones too, saying, okay, with a higher gold price, they get attractive again?
I look at some of them, although I tend not to be I wouldn't call myself an optionality guy, and that is,
yeah.
I don't look for things that are unprofitable. It might be profitable. I prefer to look at situations where they should work at this gold price, and if the gold price gets better, that's just going to be a bonus. I don't want to depend on a higher gold price for something to work. I'd rather find things that work at this price, and they'll just work better if the price goes up.
Where do the seniors look for acquisitions? Are they down? Which level do they look for?
They generally prefer to pick up companies that are, in a weak market, if you can wait it out, which of course the majors can, they prefer to wait until the company's basically got feasibility studies, if at all possible, maybe even into the permitting already. But one thing that you are starting to see more of, because so many of the big companies basically have gotten rid of their exploration staffs and cut their exploration budgets. One recent trend, and there's two or three mid-sized companies that are sort of leading the trend, they started doing more straight investments into juniors. So they're not necessarily picking up the property yet, but if they like the management team and they like what they're doing on a project, they'll buy a placement quite often above market, and they're just sort of getting their foot in their door. They're sort of the obvious company to take it over if that's the way things go. But they're basically trying to get their face out there and make sure that management groups come to them first. That's a fairly recent trend. You didn't used to see majors doing those kind of equity investments, but that's becoming more common now.
When you're looking at the time frame and you're looking at holding, et cetera, I'm thinking also, as you said, more money's coming into funds. So I just see the activity can start building at this point, looking for the very, at all three levels, of course, but looking at that activity building, and that's where you're going to see the share prices really revolve, because, as you said, the interest is now picking up.
Yeah, with juniors, it's all about news flow, and news flow, of course, is all about money because they're negative cash flow businesses. So this turn that should allow a lot more money to come in on the investment side, that's really what's going to drive the bull market in gold equities is money and news flow, and that's we're just seeing the leading edge of that now.
Can you give us a couple of names we should keep our eye on? Obviously, it's always dependent on someone's individual circumstances and risk tolerance and all that stuff. But just as an example, a couple of names that you're looking at.
I mean, the most recent company that I added to the list is a company called Monero Alamos. I'd pick them. They don't have the greatest share structure, which I was fine with. They had a huge warrant overhang that just disappeared, and that was kind of the timing for me picking it. But the reason for this one, this is all about management and execution. They've got two projects in Sonora in Mexico. They're both basically bulk tonnage gold projects, low-grade gold projects. The thing about this management team is they actually have experience building two or three mines in the past quite successfully. And normally with juniors, I tend to be really leery about a company going from being a junior to try to be a producer because, frankly, they usually screw it up. But this is a management group that's had unusually high success rate, putting very low capex heap leach projects into production. And their first mine, they just got the change of land use permit from Semarnat in Mexico, and that's sort of the big permit. It's called Santana. Their expectation is they can probably get this into production for less than $10 million. They've got $5 million in the bank. They've got a strategic deal with a company called the Cisco Royalties. I'm expecting to see an announcement within weeks of some kind of a royalty streaming deal that's going to fill the gap and allow them to build that. The guys that are building this mine, they're the same guys that built the El Castillo mine about 12 years ago, Castle Gold, which was ultimately taken out by a larger company. And I remember at the time, Dave and I didn't follow Castle Gold because we thought their capex numbers were insanely low. Like we just thought they were nuts. But as it turned out, they got it in under budget and on time. And it's the same guys building Santana. Mm-hmm. They're expecting to be in production by the middle of next year. They've got a second mine that's already permitted. They've already got the economic studies. As soon as they get Santana up and running, they'll move over to the second one, La Fortuna. I think they've got a pretty good shot at being a 100,000-ounce producer in about 2 years from a standing start. And that puts them right in the part of the Lassonde curve where you really get re-rated as you go into production. So I think these guys have got pretty high odds of being a 200 or 300% gainer over the next year or two. And I don't view it as a particularly high-risk situation because I've got a lot of respect for this management team. I've seen them do this before.
How many would you have to give me about a 10-cent acronym? Yeah. But with HRA Advisory, how many companies are you following?
Probably about, if I checked the full list, it's probably about 40 or 50 right now. Mm-hmm. Of those, I would say, 60% of them are probably gold, 40% base metal, might be 70 gold, 30 base metal.
Yeah.
My expectation is I'll be adding some more companies over the next 2 or 3 months now that we seem to have the gold market back. And yes, they will probably be gold companies. There's a few base metal things I'm looking at, but unfortunately, because I'm expecting, slowdown in the U.S. economy and this continuing trade war with China, it's difficult for me to be comfortable with base metals right now, so I'll probably be sticking to gold.
Well, I'll just tell you this. We have got a great offer here with HRA Advisories. It's a special Money Talks offer. Go to Money Talks, mikesmoneytalks.ca. It's a 90% discount. I said, you want to hear about those companies? Well, all you have to do is pay $7 for 3 months, and you get a sneak preview at what Eric is following right now. That's $7 for 3 months. I'll give you more on that in a moment. But my thanks to Eric Coffin. Student debt has been one of the big issues in the States, with a record $1.6 trillion outstanding. That's shocking enough, which if several Democratic Party candidates have their way, will be the latest entree on the free lunch express because they're promising to forgive the debt. I mean, that could be a winner for potential voters whose idea of a sound policy is to have someone else pay for something they want. And for the majority of university graduates, the amount of debt they took on actually tops their list as their biggest regret. This year, about 70% of college students graduated with student loan debt on average around $33,000 per student. But that debt problem is exacerbated by this week's shocking stat. After debt, as the biggest regret, what is it? Their chosen field of study. Maybe not surprising. you know, for people who majored in the humanities, were most likely to regret their education. Listen to this. 75% of the people who had humanities majors regretted taking that as their major in college. Followed very closely by 73% of the graduates in social sciences or physical and life sciences and art said the same thing. Basically, three quarters, hey, they regret the debt, but my gosh, they don't feel they got anything for it. 75%. And who's most likely, by the way, to be pleased with their choice? Well, you could probably guess this, the STEM people, people who studied science, technology, engineering, and math. One other interesting aspect is that the most dissatisfied group were millennials, with only 29% happy with their choice. It's like they're surprised, you know, all these people, they kind of get out of them, graduate, and they're surprised that there's not a big job market waiting them after 4 years of something like cultural anthropology or diaspora studies or folklore and ethnology. I mean, you name it. And now they're surprised, and now they have regret. I'm sure they're all worthy areas of study, by the way. It was just a stretch to see a job-ready market for those skills. But as I said, somehow that seems to shock many graduates. But 75% of humanities majors say that's the big regret coming out of college after the amount of student debt they took on to study something they now regret studying. I'm going to take a break coming back. Oh, just a reminder on, I had to rush through that. If you've just joined us, well, you heard Eric Coffin, but we have a special Money Talks deal for HRA advisory, and it's pretty straightforward. All you have to do is go to Money Talks or mikesmoneytalks.ca, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and the deal is an amazing one. You can test drive the HRA advisory for $7 a month for 3 months. Give me a break. $7 a month for 3 months. Plus, you can get a free sneak peek at the HRI special delivery alert service. No additional cost to that. So, as I say, just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, and you'll see right there, you can just click on the offer there to get the 60 socks that Eric's following, the latest thinking he's got on that stuff. But $7 for only 3 months, and this is such a great time to be doing that. Let's go to get Ozzie Jurek here. There's a lot in my mind today. Ozzie, I'm not sure. You obviously caught the numbers for May, but there was one number that jumped out at me, and that there's been an 89% decline in the number of pre-sales. And my feeling is that people have no clue about how that important it is. What's happening out in Greater Vancouver, I just think is just such a typical thing of when ignorance meets incompetence. And that is Vancouver's got a problem. They've got a population that continues to grow 30, 40,000 new people every year. Whether you're building one new unit or, you know, 5,000 new units, you've got a problem with supply. And we find out there's been an 89% drop in the number of pre-sales. And what people don't seem to understand is that means the projects get put on hold. Pre-sale is how they finance the building. And they just doesn't seem to register with people. So they're sort of saying, isn't this great? We have this big decline in the market. No, it's not. It's just guaranteeing a bigger supply problem later.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, it seems like pre-sales or real estate or development, it's almost like a dirty word. I mean, let's face it, the developer takes a huge risk. He has to find the land, he has to tie it up, he has to keep it, he has to have a plan, he has to have a 100-suite building. That means he needs architect, lawyers, planners before he goes to the city. And then the process at the city to get approval probably takes 4 years. Throughout that process, that lengthy process, he hires a lot of different people. But he incurs also the development cost charges cities have. The density bonus fees, the community amenity contribution, the building permits fees, off-site costs. I mean, it's unreal when you add, the municipality seems to just add the costs. On top of the fact we have on the other side of the government, the stress test makes it harder for the buyer to come. So the developer cannot build without the bank, and the bank will not give him the loan unless he gets 60% of his units sold. You know, and the bank checks out the developer, and then it still says, look, you're a nice guy, you have a good record, but still, you have to sell 60% of the building, or we don't give you the construction loan.
Yeah, and what it's incredible is how that's very straightforward, and you've done a great job there. And yet people, As I say, I've been dumbfounded and I've been appalled at members of the media who somehow think it's a good idea to have such a dramatic slowdown like this, which means jobs are lost, government revenue is down. But the big problem is it means supply doesn't keep coming on, and they need supply in that area. And it's just a great example of really incompetence, in my view. It's just the things you also mentioned, by the way. People want to know why building's so expensive. Well, you just gave the list there. But every month that it's delayed costs the developer more. But the point you're making, which I think is so key, people don't seem to understand. If you want that building to go up, well, they'll need a construction loan. And in order to get that loan, they need those pre-sales. And we know there's been an 89% drop this May compared to the previous May. There's not even a word for that in economics. You don't call it a crash. You passed the crash mark 20% ago. You know what I mean? Like 89%. Wow.
But it's for the wrong reason. You know, for some reason, pre-sales are a dirty word. Look, if I buy a house and close in 2 months, that's quite normal. What if I buy a house and close in 18 months? That's a pre-sale. It's the same thing. The difference is we're governed by, rightfully so, by good regulations that our deposit as a buyer is in a trust account. But that gives the bank the confidence to advance construction financing. They don't get all the money right away. You get so much for the parking area and so much when he's in the first floor and so on. The building will be built, and the extra units will help the building. I mean, developers are now saying at many, many different meetings that up to 5,000 to 6,000 units will not be built. And people that don't understand saying, hey, that's a good thing. That will drop the prices. No, it won't. It actually will increase the prices because we have less product. Right now, the market is still in a flux on it, in the general terms. But down the road, we won't have the units that you talked about earlier. We still have 60,000 people coming from offshore. So that's 30,000 housing units we either need to build to buy or rent. Then we have 140,000 students that live here on a six-month visa. And we have probably another 60,000 that are not even registered. They all have to live somewhere. And so the pressure on the rental market and so on will increase by making it more difficult to buy, not decrease.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. But as I say, and yet I'll read a column in the Globe and Mail, and there'll be somebody cheerleading for the fall in this with no any understanding of that you're actually exacerbating the very problem that you think you're solving. It's astounding to me. Plus the other side, because it's been a theme today, is the jobs part of it. You've done a good job laying out, you know, it's not just the construction guys, but there's so many jobs tied up in it.
Unbelievable. Architects, planners, lawyers, realtors, forecasters, researchers, consultants, construction workers, cement companies, concrete specialists, environmental specialists, builders, framers, finishers. Then they need carpets, furnishings. The people buy appliances, buy heaters, kitchens, and so on. Thousands and thousands of jobs are from people that pay taxes on their income, right? I mean, all that is lost government revenue and lost city income. The thing is, it's not just the difficulty of the stress test and the difficulty at the city. I understand why existing owners don't want to pay for extra construction costs, and they want that to be carried by the new owner. But look at some of the increases. The density bonus on a 200-unit building that I know about in Coquitlam was about $3.5 million 5 years ago. Now it would be between $6 and $7 million. Well, the city says it's based on land value. So here we have, into a market that is actually falling, the city of Coquitlam doubled its DCC rates, its development cost charges. So, yeah, you know, like one side of the equation increases the taxes, the other one makes it more difficult to build.
Yeah, and then just wait for it, because you know, the sort of, with the interest rates at least flat and they're not going up anytime soon, maybe even dipping a little. But anyways, we go into this period, and then all of a sudden, but the population's been growing every month while we haven't been building. Every month where the project gets put on hold, we haven't been building. Presto, you're guaranteeing an affordability problem and a rent squeeze in the future. The very people who say they're handling it are absolutely exacerbating it. And as I say, for me, Ozzy, I'm just dumbfounded by the number of cheerleaders out there. You know, it's
And everything is built on unaffordability. Vancouver has never been affordable in 30 years, according to the University of British Columbia. We just simply have had more than $65,000 income to afford a house. The affordability is not the problem. You want to live in Vancouver, it's more expensive, like Hong Kong, New York, London. There are certain areas just you can never have them affordable to come below that 30% income. Just won't happen. Never did happen. It is just a red herring. In the meantime, our costs are going up dramatically for the developer. I mean, we now have to build garbage collection inside the building, which means we have to have a 30-foot entry for a garbage truck to put the garbage can on top. That costs extra money. You have to have fresh air inside the suite 24 hours a day, right? At the same time, they want walls and windows to be airtight. So you've got all these problems from the developer side. They're real and genuine and add costs. At the same time, they make it hard for buyer to buy. Result is 89% decline.
Well, and then the same politicians will run out and say how much they care about affordability, and we'll have a gullible media eating it up without pointing the spotlight on them. Enough of that, Ozzie. I'm going to get myself in trouble. I see my language is going to really deteriorate here. Give me one hot property to put a smile on my face.
Well, we got a nice investment property in Chilliwack, lovely city, all totally renovated, really nice, $190,000. It was $220,000, so it's a good deal, and the owner will guarantee the rent and manage it for a year as well.
Wow. Just go to juroc.com, juroc.com. Ozzie, go out and have a great weekend. Great job.
Thanks, Mike. You too, and your listeners as well.
Let's go to the trading desk now. Looking forward to it live from there. I've got Drew Zimmerman, PI Financial. Drew, lots of stuff this past week, but I was kind of interested because it's usually a very, very quiet week because of Canada Day and, of course, Independence Day.
Yeah, there was lots of celebration going on. Canada Day on the Monday, Independence Day on the Thursday. But, you know, more reason to celebrate for investors is the fact that you had all three U.S. equity indices hitting record highs. Is very bullish, everything that we've seen going on right now. But what I want to try and do, Mike, in a very short period of time is paint the picture that says, you know, things aren't all that great. We're not, you know, just clear blue skies ahead. The global PMIs have been moving lower, the manufacturing PMIs, since the beginning of 2018. Core PCE, which is the inflation metric that the Fed's worrying about, was actually lower at the beginning of 2018 than it is right now. And they raised rates through 2018 and were expected to keep raising rates. GDP at the start of 2018 was lower than it is right now. Of course, you had that big tax-induced GDP run-up at the second half of 2018, so we are moving lower off of that. But it really is just been this huge move by the central bank, and I put a chart up on our website that outlines this, and it's three key dates that I had. The first was October 3rd of last year, and that was when Powell came out and said, we're a long way from neutral. We're going to keep raising rates. From there, we all know what happened into the fall, into the end of 2018. So then Powell came out on June 4th with his famous Powell pivot speech that the Fed was going to start looking at being easier. The markets ran up dramatically, all the way back up to our previous highs. And then we ran into some more headwinds in May. Of course, you know, trade tensions have played into this as well. But then on June 4th, Powell came out again and said, we're going to be cutting rates. I mean, he didn't say it that plainly, but that's what was
close to
understood.
Yeah.
And yes, exactly. And now we've run up all of June to new record highs. So are you betting on central bank policy or the economy? And I think everybody right now is looking at the central banks, as you have to, but you just have to know what you're playing when you're getting into this equity market.
Well, the other side of that coin we'd mentioned earlier in the show is that, you know, you look over in Germany and they got negative interest rate bonds. And I got to feel that sending some of that money into the U.S. markets, creating those record highs.
Well, that's exactly it. As you were talking with Eric Coffin about gold, is, you know, we're making the acronym TINA. There is no alternative. So when you've got German rates negative out to 20 years, the U.S. 10-year rate has gone from 3.25 to 1.95. I mean, that's a huge drop-off in your return in U.S. treasuries. So you're forcing investors out the risk curve. They have to go into equities. And at the same time investors are going into equities, the corporate buybacks is the corporation themselves issuing debt and going into their own shares, buying back their own shares. So those two things are pushing the market to new highs. And then as you get to new highs, you also get people having some FOMO, that, you know, the fear of missing out of this great stock rally. So this thing can feed on itself. I'm just putting this picture out there because I think everybody needs to be cautious and understand what the equity market is representing at this point. But at the same time, when those forces are at play, this market could still run sure. dramatically.
Well, for more, you got to go to polarfuturesgroup.com, polarfuturesgroup.com. You can see the chart Drew was just alluding to. Drew, thanks so much for finding time on the weekend. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me on today, Mike.
Since 2014, you know, one of the big themes on Money Talks has been the rise of civil violence, and that brings me to this week's Goofy Award. I'm not sure if you caught it. Last Saturday in Portland, Oregon, editor for Quillette.com, Andy Ngo, was savagely beaten by members of Antifa. In an article in the Wall Street Journal, he recounts the incident in quotes. "No hate, no fear," they chanted, the left-wing crowd, as they marched downtown Saturday. "I walked to the front of the line to record the protesters with my new GoPro camera when I was suddenly slammed on the back of my head with something hard. Dazed and still hearing faint chants of no hate, I was then punched and kicked by perhaps a dozen masked people in black at an Antifa event meant to resist fascist violence. I, a journalist of color, was beaten so badly I was hospitalized for a brain hemorrhage." You know, it's incredible. Obviously, the unprovoked attack is more than upsetting. But here's the thing. It was the reaction of so many apologists who invoked the "he had it coming" narrative, including Snopes.com, the fact-checking site who got every fact wrong about the incidents in the aftermath. If you haven't seen it, you can go to YouTube and type in Andy NGO pronounced no, NGO pronounced no, and just have a look at it. It's appalling. But still, the New York Times' Mike Baker blamed Mr. No. Widely published freelance writer Noah Berlatsky wrote that while he did not know the details of what happened, he called Andy Ngo a journalist, says it's inaccurate to call him a journalist, and does nothing but gives fascists a propaganda victory. I mean, are you kidding me? Charlotte Clymer, he's a writer, communication staffer for Human Rights Campaign, arguably the premier LGBT rights group. While saying the violence is completely wrong, she followed it up by stating that Ngo's goal from the start was to be beaten up and hospitalized because of a brain hemorrhage. I mean, come on. On it went. You know, one of the other themes of Money Talks that is profoundly impacting society is we've allowed extremism to go mainstream, and it's in the media. It's in those kind of actions that we saw by Antifa. It's incredible. The number of apologists for Antifa, a group of cowardly thugs under the guise of calling anyone who doesn't strictly adhere to their agenda, no, they're fascists, that's what they are, and they deserve to be beaten. This is just some more proof. Incredible. We let the extremists in. We shouldn't be surprised what's next. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.